Welcome to the Deep Dive. You're here because you want to grasp the complex ideas quickly and thoroughly without feeling, well, overwhelmed. Today we're diving into some really fascinating arguments for a supernatural designer, all based on material you shared with us, specifically Dr. Jim Spiegel's Philosophy of Religion, Session 3.
That's right. And we're going to look at really two key ways thinkers have approached this. First up is the teleological argument. You might know it as the argument from design. Then we'll dig into the argument from mind or consciousness. Both kind of take things we observe, you know, the world around us, our own minds, and use them as pointers, maybe, towards a supernatural creator.
Okay, let's tackle that first one, the teleological argument. Sounds a bit heavy, that name.
It does, doesn't it? But yeah. The core idea is pretty simple, really. Teleological comes from telos, Greek for purpose or goal, as Dr. Spiegel points out. So it's basically saying the world looks like it's designed for something. It has purpose.
Ah, okay. Like seeing an intricate machine and thinking, someone must have made this.
Exactly that intuition. And Dr. Spiegel mentions different kinds of design we might see. Could be order, like patterns in nature.
Right.
Or purpose, what things do. Complexity, obviously.
Right.
How parts fit together, unity, even, you know, beauty or information content.
He had that great example, the human eye lens.
Yeah.
With the, what was it, 7 layers? All precisely spaced.
Yeah, exactly. That specific spacing needed for clear vision, that's a prime example of order serving a purpose.
Yeah.
And he also mentioned temporal order, things like biological cycles, sleep-wake, monthly cycles, those rhythms.
Mm. They suggest some kind of underlying arrangement.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Which I guess brings us to William Paley, the watch guy. I've definitely heard of this analogy.
Oh, yes. Paley, late 18th century. His big idea was, imagine you're walking and you find a watch on the ground.
Okay.
You look at it, see all the tiny gears, springs, how they all work together perfectly to tell time. You'd instantly think, this had a maker.
Right.
An intelligent designer, even if you'd never seen a watch being made before.
Yeah, absolutely. It's obviously not just a random lump of metal.
Precisely. So Paley said, look at the natural world. It's way more complex, more intricate than any watch. Doesn't that also strongly suggest an intelligent designer, just on a cosmic scale?
Makes sense.
He laid it out pretty clearly. Watches have order, complexity, unity. They work towards an end. Someone designed them. The world had these features, too. So, conclusion. The world probably has an intelligent designer.
But Dr. Spiegel brought up David Hume, who apparently had issues with this even before Paley wrote it.
Yeah, Hume, the skeptic, he poked a pretty big hole in it. He said the analogy isn't that strong. Why? Because we have seen watches being made by people. Our conclusion about a watchmaker is based on experience, on observation.
But we haven't seen universes being made.
Exactly. That's the key difference, Hume argued. We lack that observational precedent for universes. So the jump isn't as solid. He suggested maybe there are natural ways apparent design could arise without needing, you know, a supernatural explanation.
Right. That's a powerful critique. So, okay, how does the fine-tuning argument fit in? Is that like design argument 2.0?
Kind of, yeah. It's more modern, coming out of what we now understand about physics and cosmology. Instead of focusing on biology like Paley often did, it looks more at what Dr. Spiegel calls inanimate design.
Inanimate design.
Yeah, the basic structure of the universe itself, the laws of physics, the fundamental constants. The argument is that they are incredibly precisely fine-tuned within a razor-thin range that allows life to exist at all. Robin Collins is a big name here.
So it's not about how life started, but just the fact that the universe's basic rules allow any complex life to even be possible.
Exactly that. Collins starts with something pretty much all cosmologists and physicists agree on. The universe does show this incredible balance. For life, any complex system, really you need stability, you need complexity.
Okay.
And our universe's fundamental parameters, things like gravity's inverse square law, Avogadro's constant, the strong and weak nuclear forces holding atoms together, even the speed the Big Bang expanded at, they are all dialed in just right.
Wow. So if any of those were just slightly different?
Yep. Slightly stronger gravity, universe collapses back on itself. Slightly weaker. Stars never form. Tiny change in the nuclear forces. No stable atoms beyond hydrogen, maybe helium. Change the expansion rate. Either collapses too soon or flies apart too fast for galaxies. It's incredibly precise.
That's mind-boggling, actually.
It really is. And Collins brings in this idea, the principle of confirmation. Basically, if you have an observation and two competing explanations, the explanation that makes the observation more probable is the one the evidence supports more strongly.
Okay, so the observation is the fine-tuning. What are the two explanations?
Theism, there's an intelligent designer who set things up. And atheism specifically, the idea that we have just this one universe and it just happened to be this way by chance.
Right. So how did the fine-tuning weigh in, according to Collins?
He argues that given theism, the fine-tuning isn't really improbable, maybe not guaranteed, but certainly not surprising if a creator exists.
Makes sense.
But under the atheistic single universe idea, getting this precise set of conditions by pure chance is incredibly, almost infinitesimally improbable. Like winning a cosmic lottery with impossible odds.
So the sheer unlikelihood under atheism is the key.
That's the core of it. So Collins concludes, this fine-tuning data doesn't necessarily prove God, but it provides strong evidence favoring theism over that single universe atheistic hypothesis.
Okay, but surely there are objections. So Dr. Spiegel mentioned one. Maybe there's some deeper undiscovered law.
Yes, the more fundamental law objection. The idea is maybe all these constants we see aren't independent. Maybe they're all dictated by one single underlying theory of everything we just haven't found yet.
So it wouldn't be a coincidence. It would be inevitable because of that deeper law.
Right. But Collins' reply is, well, first, that's pure speculation right now. We have no independent evidence for such a law. He calls it ad hoc, invented just to explain away the fine-tuning.
And had-cooting.
Yeah.
Just made up for this purpose.
Pretty much, yeah. An explanation devised to save a theory, but without its own independent testability or evidence. And second, even if there was such a law, wouldn't we then ask why that specific fundamental law? Why one that yields life-permitting parameters? Mm. It kind of just pushes the question back a step.
Okay. What about the objection about, well, other kinds of life? Maybe life could exist under totally different laws.
That's another common one. Maybe we're being too narrow-minded, basing life on carbon and water. Maybe under wildly different physics, some other bizarre form of complexity could arise.
Sounds plausible. Maybe. We can't imagine everything.
Collins pushes back here. He argues that any conceivable life form, whatever it's made of, would still need certain basic things. Complexity, stability over time, some kind of unified processing like metabolism.
Mm-hmm.
And achieving that kind of stable complexity, he argues, likely requires the fundamental constants to be within some kind of relatively narrow life-permitting range, even if it's not exactly our range. Our basic understanding of what life is seems to require that.
Okay, that makes sense. And then the big one, the many universes hypothesis. Or the multiverse.
Ah, yes, the multiverse.
Yeah.
If there are zillions, maybe infinite, universes, each with different random laws and constants, well, then it's not surprising that one of them, by sheer chance, would happen to have the right conditions for life. We just happen to be in that lucky one.
Like the monkeys in Shakespeare idea. Infinite monkeys, infinite typewriters, eventually one types Hamlet.
Exactly that analogy.
Yeah.
So what's Collins' response?
Yeah, what is it? Because that sounds like it could explain the odds.
Well, again, he points to the lack of independent evidence. We have zero direct observational evidence for other universes or for a universe generator machine that spits them out. It's a theoretical possibility in some physics models, but...
But not proven science. More like science fiction at this point.
He basically says, yeah, think Hollywood, not empirical science. He again labels it an ad hoc hypothesis brought in specifically to counter the fine-tuning evidence without its own verifiable basis.
So just assuming universes exist to solve the problem.
Right. And he makes another point. Even if there were some kind of universe-generating mechanism, wouldn't that mechanism itself need to be incredibly specific and well-designed to produce universes capable of supporting life? Where did it come from?
Huh. Okay, so it potentially pushes the design question back again. It seems like every naturalistic explanation runs into its own hurdles.
That's certainly how proponents of the fine-tuning argument see it.
Okay, let's shift gears then. The argument from mind or consciousness. This feels different, more philosophical maybe.
It definitely digs deep into philosophy, yeah. This argument essentially says, look at consciousness, especially human consciousness. It exists. Where did it come from? It needs a sufficient cause. And the argument concludes that cause is God, sometimes called the argument from rationality or the anthropological argument.
And Dr. Spiegel started by contrasting two main views of what humans are, right? Dualism and physicalism.
Exactly. Dualism is the sort of traditional, often theistic view. We're made of two distinct things, a physical body and a non-physical mind or soul or spirit.
Mind and body are separate.
Right. Physicalism, on the other hand, says, nope, it's all physical. Everything, including us, is just matter and energy. All our thoughts, feelings, awareness, they're ultimately just physical processes in the brain. Nothing more.
Okay. So dualism says there's this non-physical part. Physicalism denies it.
Mm-hmm.
What are the arguments for dualism? Spiegel mentioned a few.
Yeah, the first is just the basic puzzle of awareness itself. How does purely physical stuff, neurons firing, chemicals reacting, suddenly become aware? How does matter start thinking and experiencing? It seems like a huge leap.
The hard problem of consciousness, they call it.
That's part of it, yeah. Then there's the argument from subjectivity. Yeah. This is about the unique first-person quality of experience. There's something it is like to be you right now. To feel warmth, see red, taste chocolate.
Uh-huh, my internal experience.
Exactly. And the argument is that this subjective, what it's like quality can't be fully captured by objective third-person scientific descriptions of brain activity. Science can describe the neural correlates, but not the experience itself.
Is that where the bad example comes in? Thomas Nagel.
Precisely. Nagel's, what is it like to be a bat? We could, in theory, know everything about a bat's brain and how echolocation works physically, but would we ever know what it feels like for the bat to perceive the world that way?
Probably not, no.
Nagel argued that consciousness has this irreducible subjective character that physical science seems unable to grasp.
Okay. And then intentionality. That one felt a bit abstract.
It is a bit tricky. Intentionality is about the aboutness of our mental states. Our thoughts, beliefs, desires are directed towards something. They refer to things outside themselves.
Like thinking of the president or remembering my holiday.
Exactly. Your thought is about the president or about your holiday. It points beyond your physical brain state. How does a chunk of physical matter, a pattern of neurons firing, inherently come to be about something else, especially something abstract or non-present?
Mm. How does a brain state mean something?
That's the puzzle. It seems like physical states just are, they don't inherently possess this quality of reference or aboutness.
Okay, I think I get that.
Yeah.
And lastly, he mentioned near-death experiences. NDEs.
Yeah, briefly, this is obviously controversial territory, but NDEs involve people who are clinically dead, no heartbeat, maybe no brain activity, and then revived.
And they report experiences.
Often, yes.
Yeah.
Things like floating out of their body, seeing events happening around them, sometimes things later verified, meeting deceased relatives, a tunnel of light.
Right.
Proponents argue that if consciousness can persist, perceive and have experiences even when the brain is severely compromised or non-functional, that strongly suggests consciousness isn't just a product of the brain. It implies it can exist separately.
Okay. So pulling that all together, the argument for mind basically says...
It says, humans have minds. These minds have features like consciousness, subjectivity, intentionality, maybe even the ability to exist apart from the body, which seem really hard, maybe impossible, to explain purely physically.
Right.
Therefore, our minds must have a cause that isn't purely physical, a supernatural cause. And for that cause to create minds like ours, it must itself possess mind-like qualities, intelligence, awareness, maybe personhood on a grand scale.
Leading back to the idea of God, or at least a powerful conscious creator.
That's the inference, yes.
Okay, but again, objections. The first one Dr. Spiegel mentioned was, aren't you just giving up on science?
Yeah, that's a big one. Critics like, say, Daniel Dennett argue that appealing to the supernatural for consciousness is just throwing in the towel on the scientific project. Science should keep looking for a natural physical explanation, however hard it seems.
Don't stop looking just because it's difficult.
Exactly. But the response from the dualist side is, it's not about giving up. It's about following the evidence where it leads. If decades, even centuries, of trying to explain consciousness physically keep hitting these fundamental roadblocks, subjectivity, intentionality, then inferring a non-physical cause isn't failure, it's rational assessment.
Hmm. Okay. Then there was the objection that it's just unscientific to infer something supernatural. Science deals with nature, period.
Right. The idea that invoking a non-physical mind takes you out of science and into philosophy or theology.
Yeah.
But the counter argument here is that this objection kind of assumes its own conclusion. It begs the question. The whole debate is about whether consciousness can be explained scientifically, meaning naturalistically. If the argument is that the evidence suggests it can't, then simply insisting on only scientific naturalistic explanations is just ignoring the argument itself. Maybe the scope of explanation needs to be broader than just the physical.
Okay, fair point. And finally, Occam's razor, the principle of simplicity. Isn't a purely physical explanation simpler?
That's the claim. Physicalism uses only entities we already accept matter and energy. Dualism adds this extra thing, a non-physical mind or soul. So physicalism seems simpler, more parsimonious.
And simpler is usually better, right?
Well, Occam's razor says choose the simpler explanation when other things are equal. But the dualist argues that other things aren't equal here. The very phenomena we're trying to explain, subjective experience, intentionality, are the things physicalism struggles profoundly to account for.
Ah, so if the simpler theory fails to explain key data,
then its simplicity doesn't help. If the slightly more complex theory, invoking a non-physical cause, actually does explain the data better, then Occam's razor doesn't automatically rule it out. The explanatory power might outweigh the lack of simplicity.
Okay, that makes sense. So to wrap up then, both the fine-tuning argument, looking at the cosmos, and the argument from mind, looking inwards at consciousness.
They both present phenomena, the universe's precise structure, the nature of our own awareness that seem, at least to proponents, very difficult to explain through purely random, undirected physical processes.
And therefore, they offer reasons to consider something more, a designer, a supernatural reality.
Exactly. They point towards possibilities beyond just the material world, suggesting maybe an intelligence or consciousness underlies reality.
So as we finish this deep dive, it really does leave a big question hanging there for you, our listener. When you consider this incredible precision baked into the universe's laws, and you reflect on the undeniable reality of your own subjective inner world, what does all that suggest to you about the big picture, about where we fit in? Definitely some food for thought.